spread it on your bread and eat it. When you see a mother with her child, you see love. When you feel it roil in your belly, you know what it is, even if you cannot give voice to it in words." Vashat made a triumphant gesture. "Thus also is the Lethani. But as it is greater, it is more difficult to point toward. That is the purpose of the questions. Asking them is like asking a young girl about the boy she fancies. Her answers may not use the word, but they reveal love, or the lack of it, within her heart." "How can my answers reveal a knowledge of the Lethani when I don't truly know what it is?" I asked. "You obviously understand the Lethani," she said. "It is rooted deep inside you, too deep for you to see. Sometimes it is the same with love." Vashet reached out and tapped me on the forehead. "As for this spinning leaf, I have heard of similar things practiced by other paths. There is no Aturan word for it that I know. It is like a keten for your mind, a motion you make with your thoughts to train them." She made a dismissive gesture. "Either way, it is not cheating. It is a way of revealing that which is hidden in the deep waters of your mind. The fact that you found it on your own is quite remarkable." I nodded to her. "I bow to your wisdom, Vashet. You bow to the fact that I am unarguably correct." She clapped her hands together. "Now, I have much to teach you. However, as you are still welted and flinching, let us forbear the Catan. Show me your Adamic instead. I want to hear you wound my lovely language with your rough barbarian tongue." I learned a great deal about Adamic over the next several hours. It was refreshing to be able to ask detailed questions and receive clear, specific answers in return. After a month of dancing about and drawing in the dirt, learning from Vashet was so easy it felt dishonest. On the other hand, Vashet made it clear that my hand language was embarrassingly crude. I could get my point across, but what I was doing was, at best, baby talk. At worst, it resembled the rantings of a deranged maniac. "Right now, you speak like this." She got to her feet, waved both hands over her head, and pointed to herself with both thumbs. "I want to make good fight." She gave a wide, insipid grin. "With sword." She thumped her chest with both fists, then jumped into the air like an excited child. "Come now," I said, embarrassed. "I'm not that bad." "You are close," Vashet said seriously as she sat back down on the bench. "If you were my son, I would not let you leave the house. As my student, it is only tolerable because you are a barbarian. It's as if Tempi brought home a dog that can whistle. The fact that you are out of tune stands quite beside the point." Vashet made as if she would get to her feet. "That said, if you are happy speaking like a simpleton, just say the word and we can move to other things." I reassured her I wanted to learn. "First, you say too much, and you speak too loudly," she said. "The heart of Adam is stillness and silence. Our language reflects this. Second, you must be much more careful with your gestures," she said. "With their placement and timing. They modify specific words and thoughts. They do not always reinforce what you say. Sometimes they run purposely counter to your surface meaning." She made 7 or 8 different gestures in quick succession. All of them said amusement, but each of them was slightly different. "You must also come to understand the fine shades of meaning. The difference between slim and slender, as my poet king used to say. Right now, you only have one smile, and that cannot help but make a person look a fool." We worked for several hours, and Vashet made clear something Tempi could only hint at. Aturan was like a wide, shallow pool. It had many words, all very specific and precise. Adamic was like a deep well. There were fewer words, but they each had many meanings. A well-spoken sentence in Aturan is a straight line pointing. A well-spoken sentence in Adem is like a spider web, each strand with a meaning of its own, a piece of something greater, more complex. I arrived in the dining hall for supper in a considerably better mood than before. My welts still stung, but my fingers told me the swelling on my cheek was much reduced. I still sat alone, but I didn't keep my head down as I had before. Instead, I watched the hands of everyone around me, trying to note the subtle shades of difference between excitement and interest, between denial and refusal. After supper, Vachette brought a small pot of salve which she smeared liberally across my back and upper arms, then more sparingly on my face. It tingled at first, then burned, then settled down to a dull, numb heat. Only after the pain along my back faded did I realize how tense my entire body had been. "There," Vachette said, twisting the stopper back into the bottle. "How is that?" "I could kiss you," I said gratefully. "You could," she said, "but your lip is swollen and you would doubtless make a mess of it. Instead, show me your katan." I hadn't stretched, but not wanting to make excuses, I fell into open hands and began to move slowly through the rest. As I've already mentioned, Tempe usually stopped me when I made the slightest mistake in the K-10. So when I reached the 12th position without interruption, I felt rather smug. Then, I misplaced my foot badly in Grandmother Gathers. When Vachette said nothing, I realized she was merely watching and withholding judgment until the end. I began to sweat and didn't stop until I reached the end of the K-10 10 minutes later. After I'd finished, Vachette stood stroking her chin.
"Well," she said slowly, "it certainly could be worse."
I felt a flicker of pride until she continued. "You could, for instance, be missing a leg." Then she walked in a circle around me, looking me up and down. She reached out to prod at my chest and stomach. She gripped at my upper arm and the thick muscle above my leg. I felt like a suckling pig brought to market. Lastly, she took hold of my hands, turning them over to examine them. She looked pleasantly surprised.
"You never fought before Tempe taught you?" she asked.
I shook my head.
"You have good hands," she said, her fingers running up my forearms, feeling at the muscles there.
"Half of you barbarians have soft, weak hands from doing nothing. The other half have strong, stiff hands from cutting wood or working behind a plow." She turned my hands over in her own.
"But you have strong, clever hands with good motion in your wrists."
She looked up at me questioningly.
"What do you do for a living?"
"I'm a student at the university where I work with fine tools shaping metal and stone," I explained. "But I'm also a musician. I play the lute."
Vachette looked startled, then burst into laughter. She let my hands fall and shook her head in dismay. "A musician on top of everything else," she said. "Perfect. Does anyone else know?"
"What does it matter?" I said. "I'm not ashamed of who I am."
"No," she said. "Of course you're not. That's part of the problem."
She drew in a deep breath and let it out again.
"Okay. You should know about this as soon as possible. It will save us both trouble in the long run."
She looked me in the eye.
"You're a whore."
I blinked.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Pay attention for a moment. You're not thick. You must have realized there are huge cultural differences between here and where you grew up in...
the Commonwealth," I said.
"And you're right. The cultural divide between Tempe and myself was huge compared to the other mercenaries from Ventus." She nodded.
"Part of that is because Tempe has fewer wits than tits," she said. "And he is as fresh as a baby chick when it comes to making his way in the world."
She waved a hand.
"All that aside, you're right. There are huge differences."
"I noticed," I said. "You don't seem to have a nudity taboo for one thing. Either that or Tempe is a bit of an exhibitionist."
"I'd be curious how you found that out," she chuckled. "But you're right. Strange as it may seem to you, we have no particular fear of a naked body."
Vachette looked thoughtful for a moment, then seemed to reach some kind of decision.
"Here. It will be simpler to show you. Watch." I watched the familiar Adam impassivity slide over her face, leaving her face blank as new paper. Her voice lost most of its inflection at the same time, shedding its emotional content.
"Tell me what I mean when I do this," she said.
Vachette stepped close, making no eye contact. Her hand said, "Respect."
"You fight like a tiger."
Her face was expressionless, her voice flat and calm. She grabbed hold of the top of my shoulder with one hand and gripped my arm with the other, giving it a squeeze.
"It's a compliment," I said.
Vachette nodded and stepped back. Then she changed. Her face grew animated. She smiled and met my eyes. She stepped close to me.
"You fight like a tiger," she said, her voice glowing with admiration.
One of her hands rested on the top of my shoulder while the other slipped around my biceps. She squeezed. I was suddenly embarrassed at how close we were standing.
"It's a sexual advance," I said.
Vachette stepped away and nodded.
"Your folk view certain things as intimate. Naked skin, physical contact, the nearness of a body, love play. To the Adem, these are nothing remarkable."
She looked me in the eye.
"Can you think of a single time you have heard one of us shout, raise our voice, or even speak loudly enough we can be overheard?"
I thought for a moment, then shook my head.
"That is because for us, speaking is private, intimate. Facial expression, too. And this?"
She pressed her fingers to her throat.
"The warmth a voice can make, the emotion it reveals, that is a very private thing."
"And nothing carries more emotion than music," I said, understanding. It was a thought too strange for me to cope with all at once.
Vachette nodded gravely. "A family might sing together if they are close. A mother might sing to her child. A woman might sing to her man."
A slight flush rose on Vachette's cheeks as she said this.
"But only if they are very much in love and very much alone."
"But you?" She gestured to me. "A musician? You do this to a whole room full of people, all at once. And for what? A few pennies? The price of a meal?"
She gave me a grave look. "And you do it again and again, night after night, with anyone?"
Vachette shook her head in dismay and shuddered a bit. While her left hand unconsciously clenched in rough gestures, horror, disgust, rebuke. It was rather intimidating getting both sets of emotional signals from her at the same time. I fought off the mental image of standing naked on the stage of the Aeolian, then moving through the crowd, pressing my body to everyone there. Young and old, fat and thin, rich, noble, and penniless commoner. It was a sobering thought.
"But play lute is the 38th position in the Catan," I protested.
I was grasping at straws, and I knew it.
"And sleeping bear is 12, she shrugged. "But you will find no bears here, or lions, or lutes. Some names reveal. The names in the K-10 are meant to hide the truth, that we may speak of it without spilling its secrets to the open air."
"I understand," I said at last.
"But many of you have been out in the world. You yourself speak a turn beautifully and with much warmth in your voice. Surely you know there is nothing inherently wrong with a person singing."
"You have been out in the world as well," she said calmly. "And surely you know there is nothing inherently wrong with having sex with three people in a row on the broad hearth of a busy inn." She looked me in the eye pointedly.
"I imagine the stone would be rather rough," I said.
She chuckled.
"Very well. Assume they had use of a blanket, too. What would you call that person?"
If she'd asked me 2 span ago, when I'd been fresh out of the Fae, I might not have understood her. If I'd stayed with Valorian any longer, it's entirely possible that having sex on the hearth wouldn't have seemed odd to me. But I'd been back in the mortal world for a while now.
A whore, I thought silently to myself, and a cheap and shameless whore to boot.
I was glad I hadn't mentioned Tempe's desire to learn the lute to anyone. How ashamed he must have felt for such an innocent impulse. I thought of a young Tempe wanting to make music but never telling anyone because he knew it was dirty. It broke my heart. My face must have given away quite a bit, because Vachette reached out to grip my hand gently.
I know this is hard for you folk to understand. So much harder because you have never even entertained the possibility of thinking otherwise. Caution.
I struggled with everything this implied.
How do you get your news? I asked.
With no troopers wandering from town to town, how do you keep in touch with the outside world?
Vachette smirked a bit at this, and made a gesture to the windswept landscape.
Does this seem to be a place that concerns itself overmuch with the turning of the world? She dropped her arm.
But it is not so bad as you think. Traveling peddlers are more welcome here than in most places. Tinkers doubly so. And we ourselves travel quite a bit. Those who take the red come and go, bringing news with them.
She laid a reassuring hand on my shoulder.
And occasionally, a rare singer or musician will travel through. But they do not play for a whole town at once. They will visit a single family. Even then, they perform while sitting behind a screen so they cannot be seen. You can tell an Adem musician because when they travel, they carry their tall screens on their backs.
Her mouth pursed a bit.
But even these are not viewed in an entirely favorable light. It is a valuable occupation, but not a respectable one.
I relaxed a bit. The thought of a place where no performer was welcome struck me as profoundly wrong, sick even. But a place with strange customs I could understand. Adapting to fit your audience is common as changing costumes to the Adema Rue.
Vachette continued, "This is the way of things, and you would do well to accept it sooner rather than later. I say this as a well-traveled woman. I've spent 8 years among the barbarians. I have even listened to music in a group of people." She said this proudly with a defiant tilt to her head. "I have done it more than once."
"Have you ever sung in public?" I asked.
Vachette's face went stony. "That is not a polite question to ask," she said stiffly, "and you will make no friends with it here."
"All I mean," I said quickly, "is that if you tried it, you might find it is nothing shameful. It is a great joy to everyone."
Vachette gave me a severe look and made a hard gesture of refusal and finality.
Quoth, "I have traveled much and seen much. Many of the Adem here are worldly. We know of musicians, and to be completely forthright, many of us have a secret guilty fascination with them. Much the same way your folk are enamored with the skill of the Modegan courtesans."
She gave me a hard look.
"But for all that, I would not want my daughter to bring one home, if you catch my meaning. Neither would it improve anyone's opinion of Tempe if others knew he had shared the Catan with such as you. Keep it to yourself. You have enough to overcome without all Edemre knowing you are a musician on top of everything."
Chapter 114. His Sharp and Single Arrow. Reluctantly, I took Vachette's advice, and though my fingers itched for it, I did not bring out my lute that night and fill my small corner of the school with music. I even went so far as to slide my lute case underneath my bed, lest the mere sight of it fill the school with rumor. For several days, I did little but study under Vachette. I ate alone and made no attempt to speak with anyone, as I was suddenly self-conscious of my language. Carceret kept her distance, but she was always there, watching me, her eyes flat and angry as a snake's. I took advantage of Vachette's excellent Aeturin and asked 1,000 questions that would have been too subtle for Tempe to understand. I waited 3 entire days until I asked her the question that had been slowly smoldering inside me since I'd climbed the foothill of the storm wall. Personally, I thought this showed exceptional restraint.
"Vachette," I asked, "do your people have stories of the Chandrian?"
She looked at me, her normally expressive face gone suddenly impassive.
"And what does this have to do with your hand talk?"
Her hand flickered through several different variations of the gesture that indicated disapproval and reproach.
"Nothing," I said.
"Does it have something to do with your fighting, then?" she asked.
No, I admitted, but surely it relates to the K-10, Bashat said, or the Lethani. Or perhaps it touches on some subtle shade of meaning you have difficulty grasping in Adamic. I am merely curious. Bashat sighed. Can I persuade you to focus your curiosity on more pressing matters? She asked, gesturing, exasperated, firm rebuke. I quickly let the matter drop. Not only was Vashat my teacher, she was my only companion. The last thing I wanted to do was irritate her, or give the impression that I was less than attentive to her lessons. With that one disappointing exception, Vashat was a sparkling font of information. She answered my endless questions quickly and clearly. As a result, I couldn't help but feel that my skill in speaking and fighting was progressing in great leaps and bounds. Vashat did not share my enthusiasm, and was not bashful about saying so. Eloquently, in two languages. Vashat and I were down in the hidden valley that contained the sword tree. We had been practicing our hand fighting for about an hour, and were now sitting in the long grass, catching our breath. Rather, I was catching my breath. Bashat was not winded at all. Fighting me was nothing to her, and there was no time when she couldn't chide me for sloppiness or reaching lazily past my defenses to cuff me on the side of the head. Bashat, I said, mustering the courage to ask a question that had been bothering me for some time. May I ask a question that is perhaps presumptuous? I prefer a presumptuous student, she said. I had hoped we were beyond the point of worrying about such things. What is the purpose of all this? I gestured between the two of us. The purpose of this, she mimicked my gesture, is to teach you enough so that you no longer fight like a little boy drunk on his mother's wine. Today, her sandy hair was tied in two short braids that hung down her back on either side of her neck. This made her look oddly girlish, and had not done wonders for my self-esteem over the last hour as she had repeatedly thrown me to the ground, forced me into submission, and struck me with countless solid but generously pulled punches and kicks. And once, laughing, she had stepped easily behind me and slapped me firmly on the ass, as if she were a lecherous taproom drunk and I some low-bodiced serving girl. "But why?" I asked. "To what purpose are you teaching me? If Tempe was wrong to teach me, why continue to teach me more?" Vashat nodded approvingly. "I've been wondering how long it would take you to ask that," she said. "It should have been one of your first questions." "I've been told I ask too many questions," I said. "I've been trying to step a little more carefully here." Vashat sat forward, suddenly businesslike. "You know things you should not. Cheyenne does not mind that you know of the Lethani, though others feel differently. But there is agreement on the subject of our K-10. It is not for barbarians. It is only for the Adem, and only for those who follow the path of the sword tree." Vashat continued. "Cheyenne's thought is thus. If you were part of the school, you would be part of Adamre. If you are part of Adamre, you are no longer a barbarian. And if you are no longer a barbarian, it would not be wrong for you to know these things." It had a certain convoluted logic to it. "That also means Tempe would not be wrong for teaching me." She nodded. "Exactly. Instead of bringing home an unwanted puppy, it would be as if he had returned a lost lamb to the fold." "Must I be a lamb or a puppy?" I sighed. "It's undignified. You fight as a puppy fights," she said, "eager and clumsy." "But aren't I already part of the school?" I asked. "You are teaching me, after all." Vashat shook her head. "You sleep in the school and eat our food, but that does not make you a student. Many children study the K-10 with hopes of entering the school and someday wearing the red. They live and study with us. They are in the school, but not of the school, if you follow me." "It seems odd to me that so many want to become mercenaries," I said as gently as possible. "You seem eager enough," she said with an edge to her voice. "I am eager to learn," I said, "not take the life of a mercenary. I mean no offense." Vachette stretched her neck, working out some stiffness. It is your language getting in the way. In the barbarian lands, mercenaries are the lowest rung of society. No matter how thick or useless a man might be, he can carry a cudgel and earn a halfpenny a day guarding a caravan. Am I right?
The lifestyle does tend to attract a rough sort of person, I said.
We are not mercenaries of that kind. We are paid, but we choose which jobs we take. She paused. If you fight for your purse, you're a mercenary. What are you called if you fight out of duty for your country?
A soldier.
If you fight for the law,
a constable or a bailiff.
If you fight for your reputation.
I had to think a bit on that one.
A duelist, perhaps?
If you fight for the good of others.
An emir, I said without thinking.
She cocked her head at me.
That is an interesting choice, she said.
Vachette held up her arm, displaying the red sleeve proudly. We Adem are paid to guard, to hunt, to protect. We fight for our land and our school and our reputations. And we fight for the Lathani. With the Lathani. In the Lathani. All of these things together. The Adem word for one who takes the red is Satan. She looked up at me. And it is a very proud thing.
So becoming a mercenary is quite high on the Adem social ladder, I said.
She nodded.
But barbarians do not know this word and wouldn't understand even if they did, so mercenary must suffice.
Vachette pulled two long strands of grass from the ground and began to twist them together into a cord.
This is why Cheyenne's decision is not an easy one to make. She must balance what is right against what is best for her school, all the while taking into consideration the good of the entire path of the sword tree. Rather than make a rash decision, she is playing a more patient game. Personally, I think she is hoping the problem will take care of itself.
How would this take care of itself? I asked.
You could have run off, she said simply.
Manny assumed you would.
If I'd decided you were not worth teaching, that would have taken it out of her hands as well. Or you could die during your training, or become crippled.
I stared at her.
She shrugged. Accidents happen. Not often, but sometimes. If Carceret had been your teacher...
I grimaced.
So, how does one officially become a member of the school? Is there some sort of test?
She shook her head.
First, someone must stand on your behalf, saying you are worthy of joining the school.
Tempe? I asked.
Someone of consequence, she clarified.
So that would be you, I said slowly.
Vachette grinned, tapping the side of her crimped nose, then pointing at me. Only took you two guesses. If you ever progress to the point I feel you won't embarrass me, I'll stand on your behalf, and you can take the test.
She continued to twist the blades of grass together, her hands moving in a steady, complicated pattern. I'd never seen another Adam idly toy with something like this while talking. They couldn't, of course. They needed one hand free to talk.
If you pass this test, you are no longer a barbarian. Tempe is vindicated and everyone goes home happy. Except for those who aren't, of course.
And if I don't pass this test? I asked.
Or what if you decide I'm not good enough to take it?
Then things grow complicated. She came to her feet.
Come. Cheyenne has asked to speak with you today. It would not be polite of us to be late.
Vachette led the way back to the small cluster of low stone buildings. When I'd first seen them, I'd assumed they were the town itself. Now, I knew they composed the school. The group of buildings was like a tiny university, except there was none of the scheduled regimen I was used to. There was no formal ranking system either. Those with their reds were treated with deference, and Cheyenne was obviously in charge. Other than that, all I had was a vague impression of a social pecking order. Tempe was obviously rather low and not well thought of. Vachette was rather high and respected. When we arrived for our meeting, Cheyenne was midway through performing the K-10. I watched silently as she moved at the speed of honey spreading on a tabletop.
The K-10 grows more difficult the slower it is done, but she performed it flawlessly. It took her half an hour to finish, after which she opened a window. A curl of wind brought in the sweet smell of summer grass and the sound of leaves. Cheyenne sat. She wasn't breathing hard, though a sheen of sweat covered her skin.
"Did Tempi tell you of the 99 tales?" she asked without preamble. "Of Aeth and the beginning of the Adem?"
I shook my head.
"Good," Cheyenne said. "It is not his place to do such a thing, and he could not do it properly."
She looked at Vachette.
"How is language coming?"
"Quickly as these things go," she said. "However."
"Very well," Cheyenne said, switching to precise, slightly accented Aeturin. "I will tell it like this, so there will be less interruption and less room for misunderstanding."
I did my best to gesture respectful gratitude.
"This is a story of years ago," Cheyenne said formally. "Before this school. Before the path of the sword tree. Before any Adem knew of the Lethani. This is a story of the beginning of such things. The first Adem school was not a school that taught sword work. Surprisingly, it was founded by a man named Aeth, who sought mastery over the arrow and the bow."
Cheyenne paused in her tale and gave a word of explanation.
"You should know that in those days use of the bow was very common. The skill of it was much prized. We were shepherds, and much set on by our enemies, and the bow was the best tool we had to defend ourselves."
Cheyenne leaned back in her chair and continued.
"Aeth did not set out to found a school. There were no schools in those days. He merely sought to improve his skill. All his will he bent upon this, until he could shoot an apple from a tree 100 feet away. Then he strove until he could shoot the wick of a burning candle. Soon, the only target that challenged him was a piece of hanging silk blowing in the wind. Aeth strove until he could anticipate the turning of the wind, and once he mastered this thing, he could not miss. Stories of his talent spread, and others came to him. Among them was a young woman named Wraith. At first, Aeth doubted she possessed the strength to draw the bow, but she was soon regarded as his finest student. As I have said, this was long years and distant miles from where we sit. In those days, the Adem did not have the Lethani to guide us, and so it was a rough and bloody time. In those days, it was not uncommon for one Adem to kill another out of pride, or from an argument, or as a proof of skill. Since Aeth was the greatest of archers, many challenged him. But a body is nothing of a target when one can strike silk blowing in the wind. Aeth slew them easily as cutting wheat. He took only a single arrow with him to a duel, and claimed that if that single arrow was not enough, he deserved to be struck down. Aeth grew older, and his fame spread. He put down roots and began the first of the Adem schools. Years passed, and he trained many Adem to be deadly as knives. It became well known that if you gave 8 students 3 arrows and 3 coins, your 3 worst enemies would never bother you again. So, the school grew rich and famous and proud, and so did Aeth. It was then that Wraith came to him. Wraith, his best student. Wraith, who stood nearest his ear and closest to his heart. Wraith spoke to Aeth, and they disagreed. Then they argued. Then they shouted loud enough that all the school could hear it through the thick stone walls. And at the end of it, Wraith challenged Aeth to a duel. Aeth accepted, and it was known that the winner would control the school from that day forth. As the challenged, Aeth chose his place first. He chose to stand among a grove of young and swaying trees that gave him shifting cover. Normally, he would not bother with precautions such as this, but Wraith was his finest student, and she could read the wind just as well as he. He took with him his bow of horn. He took with him his sharp and single arrow. Then Wraith chose her place to stand. She walked to the top of a high hill, her outline clear against the naked sky. She carried neither bow nor arrow, and when she reached the top of the hill, she sat calmly on the ground. This was perhaps the oddest thing of all, as Aeth was known to sometimes strike a foe through the leg rather than kill them. Aeth saw his student do this, and he was filled with anger. Aeth took his single arrow and fitted it to his bow. Aeth drew the string against his ear. The string Wraith had made for him, woven from the long, strong strands of her own hair. Shane met my eye. Full of anger, Aeth shot his arrow. It struck Wraith like a thunderbolt. Here. She pointed with two fingers at the inner curve of her left breast. Still seated, arrow sprouting from her chest, Wraith drew a long ribbon of white silk from beneath her shirt. She took a white feather from the arrow's fletching, dipped it in her blood, and wrote four lines of poetry. Then, Wraith held the ribbon aloft for a long moment, waiting as the wind pulled first one way, then another. Then, Wraith loosed it, the silk twisting through the air, rising and falling on the breeze. The ribbon twisted in the wind, wove its way through the trees, and pressed itself firmly against Aeth's chest. It read, "Aeth, near my heart, without vanity the ribbon, without duty the wind, without blood the victory." I heard a low noise and looked over to see Vashet weeping quietly to herself. Her head was lowered, and tears ran down her face to drip deeper spots of red under the front of her shirt. Shane continued, "Only after Aeth read these lines did he recognize the deep wisdom his student possessed. He hurried to tend Wraith's wounds, but the head of the arrow was lodged too close to her heart to be removed. Wraith lived only 3 days after that, with the grief-stricken Aeth tending her. He gave her control of the school and listened to her words, all the while the head of the arrow riding close to her heart. During those days, Wraith dictated 99 stories, and Aeth wrote them down. These tales were the beginning of our understanding of the Latani. They are the root of all Edemre. Late in the third day, Wraith finished telling the 99th story to Aeth, who now held himself to be his student's student. After Aeth finished writing, Wraith said to him, "There is one final story, more important than all the rest, and that one shall be known when I awake." Then, Wraith closed her eyes and slept, and sleeping, she died. Aeth lived 40 years after that, and it is said he never killed again. In the years that followed, he was often heard to say, "I won the only duel I ever lost." He continued to run the school and train his students to be masters of the bow, but now he also trained them to be wise. He told them the 99 tales, and thus it was the Latani first came to be known by all Edemre, and that is how we came to be that which we are. There was a long pause. "I thank you, Cheyenne," I said, doing my best to gesture respectful gratitude. "I would very much like to hear these 99 stories." "They are not for barbarians," she said, but she didn't seem offended at my request, gesturing a combination of reproach and regret. She changed the subject. How is your K-10 coming?
I struggle to improve, Cheyenne. She turned to Vachette.
Does he?
There is certainly struggle, Vachette said, her eyes still red with tears, wry amusement. But there is improvement, too.
Cheyenne nodded. Reserved approval. Several of us will be fighting tomorrow. Perhaps you could bring him to watch.
Vachette made an elegant motion that made me appreciate how little I knew of the subtleties of hand language. Gracious, thankful, slightly submissive acceptance.
You should be flattered, Vachette said cheerfully. A conversation with Cheyenne and an invitation to watch her fight.
We were making our way back to a sheltered box valley where we typically practice the K-10 and our hand fighting. However, my mind kept spinning back to several unavoidable and unpleasant thoughts. I was thinking about secrets and how people long to keep them. I wondered what Kilvin would do if I brought someone into the fishery and showed them the sigildry for blood and bone and hair. The thought of the big artificer's anger was enough to make me shiver. I knew the sort of trouble I would face. That was clearly laid out in the university's laws. But what would he do to the person I had taught these things to?
Vachette slapped my chest with the back of her hand to get my attention. I said you should be flattered, she repeated.
I am, I said. She took hold of my shoulder, turning me to face her.
You've gone all pensive on me.
What will be done with Tempe if all of this ends badly? I asked bluntly. Her cheerful expression faded.
His reds will be taken away, and his sword, and his name, and he will be cut away from the Latanta.
She drew a slow breath.
It is unlikely any other school would take him after such a thing, so this would effectively exile him from all Edemre.
But exile won't work for me, I said. Forcing me back into the world would only make the problem worse, wouldn't it?
Vachette didn't say anything.
When all of this started, I said, you encouraged me to leave. If I had run, would I have been allowed to go?
There was a long silence that told me the truth of it, but she said it aloud, too.
No. I appreciated not being lied to about it.
And what is my punishment to be? I asked.
Imprisonment?
I shook my head.
No. It's not practical to keep me locked up here for years.
I looked up at her.
So what?
Punishment is not our concern, she said. You are a barbarian after all. You did not know you were doing anything wrong. The main concern is to prevent you from teaching others what you have stolen, to keep you from using it to your own profit.
She hadn't answered my question. I gave her a long look.
Some say killing you would be the best way, she said frankly. But most believe killing is not in keeping with the Lathani. Cheyenne is among these, as am I.
I relaxed slightly. That was something, at least.
And I don't suppose a promise on my part would reassure anyone?
She gave me a sympathetic smile.
It speaks well of you that you came back with Tempe, and you stayed when I tried to drive you away, but the promise of a barbarian amounts for little in this.
What then? I asked, suspecting the answer and knowing I wasn't going to like it.
She took a deep breath. You could be prevented from teaching by removing your tongue or putting out your eyes, she said frankly. To keep you from using the K-10, you might be hobbled, your ankle tendon cut, or the knee of your favored leg lamed. She shrugged. But one can still be a good fighter even with a damaged leg, so it would be more effective to remove the two smallest fingers from your right hand. This would be...
Vachette kept speaking in her matter-of-fact tone. I think she intended it to be reassuring, calming. But it had the opposite effect. All I could think of was her cutting off my fingers as calmly as you would pare away a piece of apple. Everything grew bright around the edges of my vision, and the vivid mental picture made my stomach roll over. I thought for a moment I might be sick. The lightheadedness and nausea passed, As I came to my senses, I realized Vachette had finished talking and was staring at me. Before I could say anything, she waved a hand dismissively. "I see I will get no more use of you today. Take the rest of the evening for yourself. Get your thoughts in order or practice the K-10. Go watch the sword tree. Tomorrow we will continue." I walked aimlessly for a while, trying not to think about my fingers being cut away. Then, coming over a hill, I stumbled almost literally onto a naked Adem couple tucked away in a grove of trees. They didn't scramble for their clothes when I burst out of the trees, and rather than try to apologize with my poor language and fuddled wits, I simply turned and left, face burning with embarrassment. I tried to practice the K-10, but couldn't keep my mind on it. I went to watch the sword tree, and for a while, the sight of it moving gracefully in the wind calmed me. Then, my mind drifted, and I was confronted with the image of Vachette paring off my fingers again. I heard the three high bells and went to dinner. I was standing in line, half stupid with the mental effort of not thinking of someone maiming my hands, when I noticed the Adems standing nearby were staring at me. A young girl of about 10 wore an expression of open amazement on her face, and a man in his mercenary reds looked at me as if he had just seen me wipe my ass with a piece of bread and eat it. Only then did I realize I was humming. Not loud, exactly, but loud enough for those nearby to hear. I couldn't have been doing it for long, as I was only 6 lines into Leave the Town Tinker. I stopped, then lowered my eyes, took my food, and spent 10 minutes trying to eat. I managed a few bites, but that was all. Eventually, I gave up and headed to my room. I lay in bed, running through the options in my mind. How far could I run? Could I lose myself in the surrounding countryside? Could I steal a horse? Had I even seen a horse since I'd been in Hert? I brought out my lute and practiced my courting a bit, all 5 of my clever fingers flicking up and down the long neck of the lute. But my right hand ached to strum and pick notes from the strings. It was as frustrating as trying to kiss someone using only 1 lip, and I soon gave up. At last, I brought out my shade and wrapped it around myself. It was warm and comforting. I drew the hood over my head as far as it would go and thought of the dark piece of fey where Falurian had gathered its shadows. I thought of the university, of Will and Sim, of Ari and Davy and Fella. I had never been popular at the university, and my circle of friends had never seemed particularly large. But the truth was, I'd simply forgotten what it was like to be truly alone. I thought of my family then. I thought of the Chandrian, of Cinder, his fluid grace, his sword held easy in his hand like a piece of winter ice. I thought of killing him. I thought of Denna and what the Cathay had told me. I thought of her patron and the things I had said during our fight. I thought about the time she had slipped on the road and I had caught her, how the gentle curve above her hip had felt against my hand. I thought about the shape of her mouth, the sound of her voice, the smell of her hair, and eventually, I stepped softly through the doors of sleep. Chapter 115, Storm and Stone. I woke the next morning knowing the truth. My only way out of this situation was through the school. I needed to prove myself. That meant I needed everything Vachette could teach me as quickly as possible. So the next morning, I rose in the pale blue light of dawn, and when Vachette emerged from her small stone house, I was waiting for her. I was not particularly bright-eyed or bushy-tailed, as my sleep had been filled with troubling dreams, but I was ready to learn. I realize now that I may have given an inaccurate impression of Hert. It was no thriving metropolis, obviously, and it couldn't be considered a city by any stretch of the imagination. In some ways, it was barely a town. I do not say this disparagingly. I spent the majority of my young life traveling with my troop, moving from small town to small town. Half the world is made of tiny communities that have grown up around nothing more than a crossroads market, or a good clay pit, or a bend of river strong enough to turn a mill wheel. Sometimes these towns are prosperous. Some have rich soil and generous weather. Some thrive on the trade moving through them. The wealth of these places is obvious. The houses are large and well-mended. People are friendly and generous. The children are fat and happy. There are luxuries for sale, pepper and cinnamon and chocolate. There is coffee and good wine and music at the local inn. Then there are the other sort of towns. Towns where the soil is thin and tired. Towns where the mill burned down or the clay was mined out years ago. In these places, the houses are small and badly patched. The people are lean and suspicious, and wealth is measured in small, practical ways. Cords of firewood, a second pig, 5 jars of blackberry preserve. At first glance, Hert seemed to be this sort of town. It was little more than tiny homes, broken stone, and the occasional penned goat. In most parts of the Commonwealth, or anywhere in the Four Corners for that matter, a family living in a small cottage with only a few sticks of furniture would be viewed as unfortunate, one step away from paupers. But while most of the Adem homes I had seen were relatively small, they weren't the same sort you would find in a desperate Aeturin town, made of sod and logs chinked with mud. The Adem homes were all snug stone, fit together as cunningly as anything I had ever seen. There were no cracks letting in the endless wind, no leaking roofs, no cracking leather hinges on the doors. The windows weren't oiled sheepskin or empty holes with wooden shutters. They were fitted glass, tight as any you'd find in a banker's manor. I never saw a fireplace in all my time in Hert. Don't get me wrong, fireplaces are better than freezing to death by a long step. But most of the rough ones folk can build for themselves out of loose field stone or cinder brick are drafty, dirty, and inefficient. They fill your house with soot and your lungs with smoke. Instead of fireplaces, each Adem home had its own iron stove. The sort of stove that weighs hundreds of pounds. The sort of stove made of thick drop iron, so you can stoke it until it glows with heat. The sort of stove that lasts a century and costs more than a farmer earns from an entire year of hard harvesting. Some of these stoves were small, good for heating and cooking, but I saw more than a few that were larger and could be used for baking, too. One of these treasures was tucked away in a low stone house of only 3 rooms. The rugs on the Adem floors were mostly simple, but they were of thick, soft wool deeply dyed. The floors beneath those rugs were smooth sanded wood, not dirt. There were no guttering tallow tapers or reed lights. There were beeswax candles or lamps that burned a clean white oil, and once, through a distant window, I recognized the unwavering red light of a sympathy lamp. It was this last that made me realize the truth. This was not a scattered handful of desperate folk scratching out a lean existence on the bare mountainside. They were not living hand-to-mouth, eating cabbage soup, and living in fear of winter. This community was comfortably, quietly prosperous. More than that. Despite the lack of glittering banquet halls and fancy gowns, despite the absence of servants and statuary, each of these homes was like a tiny manor house. They were each of them wealthy in a quiet, practical way.
"What did you think?" Vachette said, laughing at me. "That a handful of us win our reds and run off to lives of mad luxury while our families drink their own bathwater and die of scurvy?"
"I hadn't thought of it at all, really," I said, looking around. Vachette was beginning to show me how to use a sword. We had been at it for 2 hours, and she had done little more than explain the different ways of holding it, as if it were a baby and not a piece of steel. Now that I knew what to look for, I could see dozens of the Adem houses worked cunningly into the landscape. Heavy wooden doors were dug into bluffs. Others looked like little more than tumbles of stone. Some had grass growing on their roofs and could only be recognized by the stovepipes peeping out. A fat nanny goat grazed atop one of these, her udder swinging as she stretched out her neck to crop a mouthful of grass.
"Look at the land around you," she said, spinning in a slow circle to take in the landscape. "The ground is too thin for the plow, too jagged for horses. The summer too wet for wheat, too harsh for fruit. Some mountains hold iron or coal or gold, but not these mountains. In winter, the snow will pile higher than your head. In spring, the storms will push you from your feet."
She looked back at me.
This is our land because no one else wants it.
She shrugged.
Or rather, it became ours for that reason.
Vachette adjusted her sword on her shoulder, then eyed me speculatively.
Sit and listen, she said formally, and I will tell a story of a time long gone.
I sat on the grass, and Vachette took her place on a nearby stone.
Long ago, she said, the Adem were upheaved from our rightful place. Something we cannot remember drove us out. Someone stole our land, or ruined it, or made us flee in fear. We were forced to wander endlessly, our whole nation mendicant like beggars. We would find a place and settle and rest our flocks. Then those who lived nearby would drive us off. The Adem were fierce back then. If we had not been fierce, there would be none of us left today. But we were few, so we were always driven forth. Finally, we found this thin and windy place, unwanted by the world. We dug our roots deep into the stone and made it ours.
Bashat's eyes wandered the landscape.
But this land had little to give us, a place for our flocks to graze, stone, and endless wind. We could not find a way to sell the wind, so we sold our fierceness to the world. So we lived, and slowly we sharpened ourselves into the thing we are today, no longer only fierce, but dangerous and proud, unceasing as the wind and strong as stone.
I waited a moment to make sure she was finished.
My people are wanderers too, I said. It is our way. Nowhere and everywhere is where we live.
She shrugged, smiling.
It is a story, mind you, and an old one. Take from it what you will.
I am fond of stories, I said.
A story is like a nut, Vachette said. A fool will swallow it whole and choke. A fool will throw it away, thinking it of little worth.
She smiled.
But a wise woman finds a way to crack the shell and eat the meat inside.
I got to my feet and walked to where she was sitting. I kissed her hands and her forehead and her mouth.
Vachette, I said, I am glad Cheyenne gave me to you.
You are a foolish boy. She looked down, but I could see a faint blush rising on her face as she spoke.
Come, we should go. You do not want to miss the chance to see Cheyenne fight.
Vachette led me to an unmarked piece of meadow where the thick grass had been grazed close to the ground. A few other Adem already stood nearby waiting. Some folk had brought small stools or rolled pieces of log to use as benches. Vachette simply sat on the ground. I joined her. A crowd slowly gathered. Only 30 people or so, but it was the most Adem I'd ever seen together other than in the dining hall. They gathered in twos and threes, moving from one conversation to another. Rarely did a group of five coalesce for any length of time. Though there were a dozen conversations all within a stone's throw of me, I couldn't hear more than a murmur. The speakers stood close enough to touch, and the wind in the grass made more noise than their voices. But I could tell the tone of each conversation from where I sat. 2 months ago, this gathering would have seemed eerily subdued. A gathering of fidgety, emotionless near-mutes. But now, I could plainly see one pair of Adem were a teacher and student by how far apart they stood, by the deference in the younger woman's hands. The cluster of three red-shirted men were friends, easy and joking as they jostled at each other. That man and woman were fighting. She was angry. He was trying to explain. I suddenly wondered how I ever could have thought of these people as restless or fidgety. Every motion was to a purpose. Every shifting of the feet implied a change in attitude. Every gesture spoke volumes. Vachette and I sat close to each other and kept our voices low, continuing our discussion in Aturin. She explained how each school had standing accounts with the Sealdish moneylenders. That meant far-flung mercenaries could deposit the school's share of their earnings anywhere people used Sealdish currency, which meant anywhere in the entire civilized world. That money was then tallied to the appropriate account so the school could make use of it.
How much does a mercenary send back to the school? I asked, curious.
80%, she said.
8%?
I asked, holding up all my fingers but two, sure I had misheard.
80,
Vachette said firmly. That is the